the first career I wanted to be before chef and farmer was actually a nun, a farming nun. There is something to be said about monastic life and the idea of cooking food.
Hello, ladies and gents. Welcome to episode 17 of Hidden Apron Radio with me, Paulo Espanola, where I get the privilege to talk to some of the most amazing folks in the food space, whether it's businessmen turned rice traders, MasterChef juniors, veteran restaurateurs, or marathon running slash accountant slash YouTube, Instagram, cake live streamers. Anyone and everyone who's been on the show defies labels, and we run the whole gamut of topics about food, from philosophical ideas around authenticity and feeding others, super tactical cooking techniques, food and business, food and medicine, and the way we break our boundaries by breaking bread. It is a fun and geeky look at how food affects our lives, and these next two episodes are no exception. In fact, this next episode was one of my favorites all the way through the editing phase because it encapsulates what Hidden Apron is all about. We touch so many different aspects of food, and it is chock full of tangents. Our guest for this two-part series is Eileen Suzara. Eileen's backstory is just as random, in a good way, as many of our guests in the past. She was born in the Mojave Desert, spending time in the Big Island of Hawaii, and now in California, eating, in her words, everything from Spam, bibimbap, poi, spaghetti, poke, Pop-Tarts, and the plastic-wrapped foods of the microwave generation. She's an eco-educator, writer, and natural chef who's dabbled in everything from pre-med to environmental work to food, and founded Sariwa Kitchen. Sariwa means fresh in Tagalog, which gathers community and celebrates vibrant Filipino cuisine through pop-ups, catering, and workshops. As you can tell, we are going to touch a lot of different threads in this episode, and I personally found it very challenging, but quite refreshing to try to tie these many, many threads together, and that's what makes recording these episodes very, very fun for me. These episodes are split in two. This first one will cover the twisting path Eileen took, and I'd wager that for many of us, myself included, for whom the question, what am I going to do after college, or my life for that matter, sends cold sweats down our spine, this is going to be a very, very enlightened conversation on how to tie those strings together. We also talk about her 80-20 rules on cooking, the things that make the biggest impact on your cooking a meal, and the differences in mindset between growing food and making it, as Eileen has done both. Give this one a listen and keep on the lookout for the next episode, which covers the theme of resistance. Given the time that we live in, it's quite a timely topic. And so without further ado, Eileen Suzara. So if you were actually going to offer me a snack right now, what would it be?
Oh, a snack. Well, you know, it's still earlier over here. I think I would just give you some parts of my breakfast. So not quite a snack, but we could have some fried rice, some chocolate, and some. Right now, I'm really excited about Caracara oranges. They're probably my favorite orange.
What it makes them different?
They are crossed with grapefruits, oranges and grapefruits. Some people have strong feelings about grapefruits, but it just makes for a really extra luscious orange.
Ah, is the flesh? It's not red. The flesh is not red, then, is it?
Ish. So it's not like blood oranges, but it's kind of this ruby tinted orange.
I see.
On the inside. I see. Yeah, we're kind of pink.
I have strong feelings of grapefruit, but towards the positive end. I've been eating it since I was a kid. So I was mentioning to you earlier before I started the recording that it is it was quite difficult researching you. Welcome to the show, Eileen.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
This is already going to be a disaster. I feel like a lot of tangents are going to come up. I feel like we're going to end up talking for quite some time. But before we get started down the rabbit holes, when I was reading up on your background, you know, it spanned a lot of disciplines. There was education, there was medicine, culture, writing, farming, and I guess to use the farming analogy, it's a lot of different phases and cycles. How would you currently describe the current phase you're in right now, just to kind of level set where we're going to go with this today?
Sure. Now I'm going to end up trying to find a farming metaphor, but I think the current phase, if I could look back at those chapters and see it as crop planning and, you know, kind of selecting the next direction of what to harvest. I would say I'm really just in the phase right now of tending the things that have been planted in the past. And right now, I'm just beginning to really see, I think, the outcomes of a lot of relationship building with community around food projects and beginning to see new ground being opened up for Soriba, for the food business. So I think that's where I'm at in the cycle of food.
And I ask that because I think part of the challenge of trying to tie all these all together is that when I've done other interviews with people who have similar backgrounds as you, where they've come from all different places and they try to merge us into one big food baby, for lack of a better term, is that there's always an underlying thread, you know, whether it's the achievement of self or whether it's to connect people. And I think that's one of the things that I want to try to find out today is how all of these connect together. But if we went all the way back, you mentioned crop planning. Let's start with the beginning of the food journey. So you mentioned in other interviews before that you grew up eating quote unquote non-traditional Filipino food like Spam and canned food. I'd argue that in some way it is traditional, but that aside, you mentioned that you found an old Filipino cookbook that sparked this long and storied journey. And I actually tried to find out what this book was. Like, I've Googled it everywhere and I couldn't find any mention. What was the actual book?
Funny that you should mention that. So my mom is actually visiting from the Philippines right now, and I asked her if she could bring this cookbook with her. And this is when I started to realize, oh, maybe my memory started to fuse two books into one, from what I remember. I'm trying to look for it on my bookshelf right now. But I think it was just recipes from the Philippines, or recipes of the Philippines. Oh, here it is. One of the recipes of the Philippines, Enriqueta David Perez. And on the cover is what looks like maybe a Christmas ham with a pineapple on it, and a candle, and a bowl of apples.
That is
And on the
so,
inside,
that's not what
there's
I pictured.
none of the above. It's not what I pictured from the cover at all. And then you open it, and then just begin seeing like laksa and, you know, dinuguan and everything else in there.
I just Googled it to quickly see, and it's on Amazon. So I'm actually looking at this picture that you're describing now, and I think this is such an interesting thing because when I look at this could have been the cover of, you know, the turn of the century American cookbooks with the
Exactly.
aspics and the gelatins and the hams, and wow, would not have expected that this would be the first book that you saw. Were there any particular recipes in that book that struck out to you that kind of got the juices flowing?
Think, you know, when I look back and think, okay, 24 years ago when I first opened this cookbook, I think I was really excited for some reason about espresso. And yeah, mostly the rice-based dishes, I found those fascinating. Possibly because they were the recipes where I didn't know where a number of the recipes or what the ingredients actually were.
Oh, you mean like they were actually written in, not in the English term?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, looking at the cover of it, okay, this is like turn of the century Americana looking cover, like maraschino cherries also, which is funny. And but then on the inside, you know, under the dessert section, which I guess as a kid I immediately flipped to, like, oh, what is malagkit? I didn't know what that was. I
Ah, I
didn't know
see.
what pinipig. Just reading the ingredients, they were words that I didn't ever hear in the household, and so I think those were the first ones I first honed in on.
Got you. And for those people who are listening, by the way, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of Tagalog and Filipino and probably other dialect terms thrown in today. Don't worry, they will all be in the show notes linked. Like, I actually just Googled espresso because for me, this is actually called baye-baye. And so I was like, oh, I know what this is. There's like 100 different terms for all these things. So
So many terms.
I know. This is what makes it interesting. When you were reading this book and in the beginning when you started cooking, were you largely self-taught or you often hear of these like stereotypical stories of like cooking at your grandmother's knee, right? Were you the one who, which side did you fall on in the spectrum?
I was not, I was cooking rather than need my grandmother. I was cooking in the shadow of the microwave at that time in our life.
That's
So,
so poetic.
and I mean, that was a reality. You
Yeah.
know, it's very interesting. And I'm sure this reflects other folks' experiences too. Because now, when I often meet people or do a workshop, people think, oh, you must have had that grandmother's knee experience or,
Right.
peering over the shoulder or looking at the, traditional clay pot or whatever. It's like, no, I actually grew up eating Pop-Tarts and Spam, and that was the majority of the really formative childhood years. Cooking things in the microwave, that was the first thing I remember cooking as a child, having like free access to that. And so going from that, which was still exploration of the kitchen, it was just what was around us, being a child born in the 80s, something that was sweeping through American culture was this idea of convenience and fast things that you can make at home. Our family was very much enamored with that as well, and that was just the truth of the times.
I actually can sympathize and because I was also in the microwave generation, and I think this is why it's a little bit difficult for me because it's a little bit of a blur of how I started cooking. I do remember heating up food, but I don't actually recall learning how to cook. So I wonder if your memory is a little bit better than mine, but do you recall those first moments when you started to actually cook food on either, traditional methods or on a stove? Like, how did you go about learning?
Sure. Well, I will admit, maybe for the first time on a podcast, was that I have this distinct memory. One of the first things I cooked on the stove is we also had miniature cans of V8 in the fridge for some reason at all times. I
V8
think it
is
was some,
the
it's like
tomato juice?
that tomato juice
Oh,
with,
yeah.
carrots and whatever else was in there. I
Yeah.
think V8 was also very big in the early 90s and late 80s. And so I remember making soup using V8 as a base and then throwing in vegetables. And that was the first soup I ever made, like as an 8-year-old.
That's so.
Granted, V8 actually the base is really soup-like, so I don't think that was too far off. But
It is
that
because
was the first thing.
the salt is actually enough to get there to soup when I
Yeah,
look
this is
at it.
not like a sweet thing. So V8 soup, that was it.
You should
But
write
from
a
that,
cookbook.
I think the next thing that was made that was based off of this cookbook probably was Espresso. And partly because it was some of the ingredients, at the time our family was living in the Mojave Desert. Those were things that we could actually find at the one Asian food store that was tucked away in the desert. So Espresso
Got
was
you.
a pretty easy gateway food. And then, garlic fried rice, all the base, kind of the basic things.
Yeah, and I'm already hearing this theme of locality in a more modern context. I'm sure when we think local, we often think of like green produce growing in my background, but the issue of local is often a lot broader than that. And the
Exactly.
reason I ask this is because I think there is a gap between what it was before, where there's a strong, whether it's structure in the community or the family, where the parent or grandparent passes on, these food practices to the next in line. And then there seems to have been a split where there no longer is that, or at least to a lesser extent, where at least for me, I was told like stay out of the kitchen, right? Like go learn to be a businessman. Like this is no place for you. And so it's always interesting to hear how people go through that learning process in the absence of these structures. So going from the V8 soup, did you go about learning cooking in a more structured way before you went to culinary school? Like was there, did you say, you know what, I'm just going to teach myself how to cook using these three cookbooks, or I'm going to ask my friend? Was there some sort of structure, or is it totally whatever I find around me, I'm going to find a way to put it on the stove?
Sure. A little bit more of the latter. And I love this question because I think, the narrative, which I kind of romanticize even now, is still, oh, heritage is passed down one generation to the next. But given any number of circumstances, sometimes that's not always so clean cut and so smooth. And yeah, I think, I will say that, truth be told, my parents, they were in the kitchen as needed, but it wasn't their biggest passion. And I think they also migrated when they were quite young. And so I think they were also figuring things out as they went along here in the States. And my mom was really supportive of me being in the kitchen, like, okay, you want to use a knife, go ahead. You're eight. You want to use the stove. That's cool. You want to use the microwave. And so she was my partner in crime in trying to track down ingredients from this cookbook while we lived in a place that was not very supportive of food coming from a tropical ecosystem. And I would say, I think there's just this thing where sometimes you borrow across cultures and the people that you love and the people in your community. And so at this time in life, there was a Burmese family that we were really close with. And she was this incredible cook, you know, churning out dishes that she remembered from her homeland. And she actually was a place where I picked up a lot more cooking techniques as a child.
A Burmese and a Filipino family in the middle of a Mojave Desert. This is...
With tumbleweeds.
Sounds like a Sundance festival, Phil. You know what I mean?
If only, yes.
So then, here's the thing that kind of perked up my ear, because you mentioned that your mom was very supportive when you were cooking during this time. But I wonder, were they as supportive when you decided to actually switch towards food? Because I know you were studying pre-med, right? And you switched. Mm-hmm. When that switch happened, were they as supportive?
Well, let's see. Going through the years, and I will just add one extra time jump, is going from the desert was then moving to Hawaii, and that was a completely different environment with a very alive, vibrant food culture from a number of different ethnic backgrounds. And I guess it was there that I thought, okay, you know, maybe I'll consider the medical thing. But when I was, you know, in young adulthood and deciding to turn towards food, I think it was an adjustment for family. I think there was a lot of hope and pride around, you know, having this next generation enter into the health professions. Mm-hmm. And when I got really excited about food, it's something that's different. It wasn't, you know, that wasn't a pathway that was already necessarily trod on by my past generations.
Gotcha.
But I think for the family, you know, even though it was a very different thing to wrap their minds around, my parents were supportive in the ways that they knew how. And, you know, of course, I think it actually doesn't hurt that food isn't TV and they are watching these TV shows. So I think it starts planting ideas. It's not that you're just going to, you know, build your small food business. It's like, well, obviously you're going to then become the top chef, right?
Yeah. I was just going to say that because I still get those questions like, so you're going to go to top chef, right? I'm like, well, not quite, but at least you kind of get that this is like a real thing.
It's a real thing. Yeah, it's funny how having something that shows up on TV screen starts to validate different pathways.
Right. It's like, you can choose this route now because we know it's not just like a joke or something. When I read some of these bios that are written about you, it almost says it in the retrospective of like you've come full circle because this love for food is also helping address problems like chronic disease or you know, declining health in certain populations. At the time when you made that switch, was that in your mind or is this more of like, oh, wow, it really did connect with the whole medicine thing?
I think I would like to say that I was aware of this, but I think I struggled for many years to figure out how to make it all come together. Mm-hmm. I think food always felt like that was the thing you do on the side, you know, in the kitchen to ground everything else.
Right.
Even though I could see the connections through nutrition, for example, it was sometimes hard to build that bridge. And even, you know, deciding to move away from medicine, my first jump wasn't straight into food. It was into environmental work. And I think that in-between place around environment was actually where seeing a pathway in food started to come a little bit more clear, given that, you know, health, ecology, all of that is based on land-based work. And at the same time, this is where the tangents begin, Paulo, is...
this is, while doing, you know what, I've given up on trying to...
Let's just do it.
It's going to happen.
It's going to happen. It's okay. I just feel like life was just one big tangent to end up back in the kitchen for myself anyways. And, you know, while doing community-based work, working in environmental campaigns or even in earlier phases working conservation, I was still struck like, oh, food is still that common thing. It's what gets people through meetings. Mm-hmm. You know, it brings people to celebrate a win or it's the thing that you share so that you feel more connected. And so, yeah, I think that the presence of food was always there. And it wasn't until years later that I began to see a different path forward with it.
Yeah, and this is exactly what I mean about, like, the underlying thread and why I think after more than 10 episodes of this podcast, I've given up on trying to cut the tangents, is because it's not the tangent that matters, it's the underlying root or what are the trunk, you could say. It's all these metaphors today. Because the previous interview I did with a runner, Isang Smith, like she, mm-hmm. her thing was just as varied, right? She was like, yeah, I went to massage and I went to Muay Thai. Then I went into acupuncture. And I'm like, where is this going? And she's like, actually, the underlying thread was all about running. And so it's interesting to see, like, you might have a story of environment and medicine and being a chef, but the underlying thread, at least from what you're saying, is still food. Is this what influenced you to pursue becoming a natural chef then? And by the way, because I'm also a little bit ignorant of the term, even though I have friends who are natural chefs, can you also define what a natural chef is?
Sure. And in doing that, I'll add that I actually think the term natural chef is a little bit funny. I've used it or heard it used in different settings. Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm like, well, you know, until we're all sitting around, you know, cooking with plastic, I would say on some level, we're all, anyone who works with food could be a natural chef. But yeah. For now, I think the way that that term has been thrown around is using foods that are whole, that really reflect seasonality or what's local to you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was, I guess, the school of training that I got to come out of was how do you cook as a natural chef, mm-hmm. But specifically with an eye towards health, whether it's working with folks who are dealing with different kinds of disease or are trying to make a certain kind of change in their life.
Does that include meat, by the way?
Yeah, it okay. does.
You're listening to Hidden Apron Radio, produced by myself, Paolo Espanola, and Ricky Ho. Just two ordinary guys trying to break bread and break boundaries. Thoughts, musings, ever just wanted to rant at us? Do let us know at hiddenapron@gmail.com or at hidden_apron on both Twitter and Instagram. Back to the show.
Just purely based on skills, what sorts of skills did you find were incredibly important when you were studying to be a chef? Like 80-20 rule.
Oh, the 80-20 rule. Can you break that down for me?
So 80-20 rule is basically, what are the 20% of skills that have impacted 80% of your work? Like if you had to boil it down into like the key skills that if you were to say, okay, if I'm going to only teach you these three skills or five skills or whatever the 20% is for you as a chef, they're going to get you to the 80% proficiency.
Ooh, all right. I'm going to use this in my life after. Thank you. I guess doing that training, when I was training and when I look back at it now, I think what it broke down, the 80-20 for me would just be really understanding ingredients. And I think to me, even though I'm still an omnivore and I'll cook for, you know, any number of diets, vegan folks, people who eat everything, I think just having a deeper understanding of ingredients is basically, 80% of what I focus on now. And in the program, you know, I think it was really saying, like, how can you look at any array of recipes or some situation that you're set up with in the kitchen and just try to find, you know, the freshest things that are available to you wherever you happen to be. And I feel like that actually is at the heart of the food that I love to cook the most.
And I think something that's often overlooked, because there's this, and I'll cover it in the second half, there's often this fear of, like, if I don't own this piece of equipment or know this certain technique, I cannot cook. Like, oftentimes, mm-hmm. you know, like, the ingredient listing on a recipe is almost an afterthought. It's like, you know, chicken breast. Like, well, what kind of chicken? It's like, there's very little focus around the ingredient itself. So I'm glad you mentioned that. Are there other skills that you would say should be a focus when someone is trying to learn to be a chef?
Yeah. And I would say this actually came out more through growing food than the natural chef training program. Growing food and just being around people who grow food. I often find that people of any ability, but especially with beginners, might think, oh, you know, if I don't have like the perfect ingredient that this recipe is calling for, then I can't make it or it's going to be messed up. Mm-hmm. And I think just the sense of, you know, make it happen with whatever you happen to have in the time. Maybe you don't have a great chef knife. That's fine. Don't let that be the barrier to cooking something. Or if you have imperfect produce, it can be just as delicious as something that is, you know, sparkly clean and sold at the top price. Mm-hmm. So I guess to me, it's really just like allowing, you know, how can you allow a recipe to just almost be as simple as possible? I fall in that camp. I admire chefs who can create works of art on the plate. But for me, I really stand true with simple things that can just shine with their flavor.
Yeah, yeah. Cooking's a lot more forgiving than I think we make it seem to be at times.
Yeah. Baking, not so much, but cooking, yes.
Yeah, that's why I kind of like really stay away from baking. Although I will say one of my mentors was saying that that's also a misconception. You know, I often, because would it be true that, you know, when we think of baking, it's so precise, right? Mm-hmm. But maybe she was taught a different way, but she's like, no, just think of it like cooking and all that fear is erased. Like if it's humid outside, you get to know how much flour you should put. I'm like, wow, I think it'll take some time before I get there, but
yeah,
you know, I'm sure there's a road, there's a will, there's a way. Switching tracks a little bit, because you talked about growing food, so I think this is a good segue to your time as an apprentice in the agroecology program at, was it UC Santa Cruz, right?
Yes, at UC Santa Cruz.
Perfect.
Good memory. Yeah.
It's also because I have all these notes now that I hope I wrote this all
right. I don't have to know that. I'm like, he just knows everything. That's great.
Oh, man. I'm glad I came off that way. If you had to link the mindset that you approached the culinary arts and then the mindset that you approached the apprenticeship program, would you say that you used the same mindset in terms of how you learned, or were they completely different? Like learning how to grow food and learning how to cook, did they both differ in terms of mindset?
I love that question. I think there is a shared mindset in just being, always staying open to a new experience, or even an experience that you've done 20 times, 100 times. There's still something to learn about it. And, you know, I think sometimes with cooking, I'll notice, okay, am I going into autopilot right now? Or am I fussing so hard over the outcome? But what I really cherished about growing food, and I recognize it was in a really privileged space, like it was an apprenticeship program, so different circumstances, but just really being able to look at the life cycle of a seed, its origins, being able to shepherd it through its entire life cycle until harvest and then processing and eventually, you know, sharing it with people who are buying food or sharing food with you in other ways. There was that magic to it. So I think the art and science of growing food to me just restored more of the magic of food and life in general. I know it sounds really cheesy, but I think just there was something that you can never grow tired or kind of get bored of seeing how life works when it's growing from seed.
Yeah, yeah. I forget the term now. There's like a Japanese term for it's called like the no mind or like the beginner's mind or something like that. It's like how you should approach a situation as if it's new all over again. So I don't think it sounds cheesy at all. I think it's quite wise. I don't know if you watch. Do you watch Chef's Table?
Have I? That's on my to-do list. To watch list. Because I don't actually watch. I only rediscovered TV again recently.
You make it sound like you're like this like 90-year-old woman who's just like, oh, what is this thing?
I am a 90-year-old woman on the inside. That's actually the truth. So yeah, TV is this like very exciting new thing to me again. I literally have not followed any series since X-Files.
Until now.
This is a tangent, but this is why I'm like, wow, Chef's Table and all of these shows. It's like a new experience after taking a break for a while.
I will agree with you though, because I actually don't have cable, but I do watch a lot of food stuff on Netflix. I brought up Chef's Table because the season 3, which just came out, the first episode was about a Buddhist monk in Korea, Jong Kwan, who basically said the exact same things you're saying now in her approach to, because she grows the food and then cooks it on the temple grounds. And it's like the same thing about the miracle of looking at the seed and seeing it grow so that when she tastes this super simple thing, it tastes that much better because she knew what goes into it. So I don't think it's cheesy at all. Because, I mean, if this monk who's using it in her daily practice is saying it, it's, wow, there's a lot of wisdom in that, right?
Side tangent note is that the first career I wanted to be before Chef and Farmer was actually a nun.
No way!
A farming nun.
What?
So I think there is something to be said about, yeah, monastic life and the idea of cooking food that also influenced.
You need to watch this episode then. You need, because okay, it's like, this might, she might be your, you know, in a different life that might, that was probably you. Just like,
I think so. I'm ready to get into that. Yeah.
That's great.
Not the actual nun or monk part, but respecting the seed to mindful cooking aspect. Yes.
Yeah. It's like the miracle of the universe in a grain of rice.